Weather considerations? Kelly asked. The mission has to go in the fall, this fall, or maybe it'll never go. You say these guys will never come back unless we get them? No other reason for them to set this place up in the way they did, Maxwell replied. Admiral, I'm pretty good, but I'm just an enlisted guy, remember? You're the only person who's been close to the place. The Admiral collected the photographs and the maps. He handed Kelly a fresh set of the latter. You turned down OCS 3 times. I'd like to know why, John. You want the truth? It would have meant going back. I pushed my luck enough. Maxwell accepted that at face value, silently wishing that his best source of local information had accumulated the rank to match his expertise. But Maxwell also remembered flying combat missions off the old Enterprise with enlisted pilots, at least one of whom had displayed enough savvy to be an air group commander. And he knew that the best helicopter pilots around were probably the instant warrant officers the Army ran through Fort Rucker. This wasn't the time for a wardroom mentality. One mistake from Song Tae, Kelly said after a moment. What's that? They probably overtrained. After a certain period of time, you're just dulling the edge. Pick the right people, and a couple of weeks max will handle it. Go further than that, and you're just doing embroidery. You're not the first person to say that, Maxwell assured him. Will this be a SEAL job? We're not sure yet. Kelly, I can give you 2 weeks while we work on other aspects of the mission. How do I get in touch, sir? Maxwell dropped a Pentagon pass on the table. No phones, no mail. It's all face-to-face contact. Kelly stood and walked him out to the helicopter. As soon as the Admiral came into view, the flight crew started lighting up the turbine engines on the SH-2 Sea Sprite. He grabbed the Admiral's arm as the rotor started turning. Was the Song Tae job burned? That stopped Maxwell in his tracks. Why do you ask? Kelly nodded. You just answered my question, Admiral. We're not sure, Chief. Maxwell ducked his head under the rotor and got into the back of the helicopter. As it lifted off, he found himself wishing again that Kelly had taken the invitation to Officer Candidate School. The lad was smarter than he'd realized, and the Admiral made a note to look up his former commander for a fuller evaluation. He also wondered what Kelly would do on his formal recall to active duty. It seemed a shame to betray the boy's trust. It might be seen that way to him, Maxwell thought, as the Sea Sprite turned and headed northeast. But his mind and soul lingered with the 20 men believed to be Sender Green. And his first loyalty had to be to them. Besides, maybe Kelly needed the distraction from his personal troubles. The Admiral consoled himself with that thought. Kelly watched the helo disappear into the forenoon haze. Then he walked toward his machine shop. He'd expected that by this time today his body would be hurting and his mind relaxed. Strangely, the reverse was now true. The exercise at the hospital had paid off more handsomely than he'd dared to hope. There was still a problem with stamina, but his shoulder, after the usual start-up pain, had accepted the abuse with surprisingly good grace. And now, having passed through the customary post-exercise agony, the secondary period of euphoria had set in. He'd feel good all day, Kelly expected, though he'd hit the bed early tonight in anticipation of yet another day's punishing exercise. And tomorrow he'd take a watch and start exercising in earnest by rating himself against the clock. The Admiral had given him 2 weeks. That was about the time he'd given to himself for his physical preparation. Now it was time for another sort. Naval stations, whatever their size and purpose, were all alike. There were some things they all had to have. One of these was a machine shop. For 6 years there had been crash boats stationed at Battery Island, and to support them, there had to be machine tools to repair and fabricate broken machine parts. Kelly's collection of tools was the rough equivalent of what would be found on a destroyer, and had probably been purchased that way. The Navy Standard Mark I Mod Zero machine shop selected straight out of some service catalog. Maybe even the Air Force had the same thing for all he knew. He switched on a South Bend milling machine and began checking its various parts and oil reservoirs to make sure it would do what he wanted. Attendant to the machine were numerous hand tools and gauges and drawers full of various steel blanks, just roughly machined metal shapes intended for further manufacturing into whatever specific purpose a technician might need. Kelly sat in a stool to decide exactly what he needed, then decided that he needed something else first. He took down the .45 automatic from its place on the wall, unloaded and disassembled it before giving the slide and barrel a very careful look inside and out. "You're going to need two of everything," Kelly said to himself. "But first things first." He set the slide on a sturdy jig and used the milling machine first of all to drill two small holes in the top of the slide. The South Bend machine made an admirably efficient drill. Not even a tenth of a turn on the four-handled wheel, and the tiny cutting bit lanced through the ordnance steel of the automatic. Kelly repeated the exercise, making a second hole 1.25 inches from the first. Tapping the holes for threads was just as easy, and a screwdriver completed the exercise. That ended the easy part of the day's work and got him used to operating the machine, something he hadn't done in over a year. A final examination of the modified gun slide assured Kelly that he hadn't hurt anything. It was now time for the tricky part. He didn't have the time or equipment to do a really proper job. He knew how to use a welding set well enough, but lacked the gear to fabricate the special parts needed for the sort of instrument he would have liked to have. To do that would mean going to a small foundry whose artisans might have guessed what he was up to, and that was something he could not risk. He consoled himself with the thought that good enough was good enough, while perfect was always a pain in the ass and often not worth the effort anyway. First he got a sturdy steel blank, rather like a can, but narrower and with thicker walls. Again he drilled and tapped a hole, this time in the center of the bottom plate, axial with the body of the can, as he already thought of it. The hole was 0.60 inches in diameter, something he had already checked with a pair of calipers. There were seven similar blanks, but of lesser outside diameter. These he cut off to a length of 3/4 of an inch before drilling holes in their bottoms. These new holes were 0.24 inches, and the shapes he ended up with were like small cups with holes in the bottom, or maybe diminutive flower pots with vertical sides, he thought with a smile. Each of these was a baffle. He tried to slide the baffles into the can, but they were too wide. That earned Kelly a grumble at himself. Each baffle had to go on his lathe. This he did, trimming down the outside of each to a shiny, uniform diameter exactly 1 millimeter less than that of the inside of the can, a lengthy operation that had him swearing at himself for the 50 minutes it required. Finished, finally, he rewarded himself with a cold Coke before sliding the baffles inside the can. Agreeably, they all fit snugly enough that they didn't rattle, but loosely enough that they slid out with only a shake or two. Good. He dumped them out and next machined a cover cap for the can, which had to be threaded as well. Finished with that task, he first screwed it into place with the baffles out, and then with the baffles in, congratulating himself for the tight fit of all the parts, before he realized that he hadn't cut a hole in the cover plate, which he had to do next, again with the milling machine. This hole was a scant 0.23 inches in diameter, but when he was done he could see straight through the entire assembly. At least he'd managed to drill everything straight. Next came the important part. Kelly took his time setting up the machine, checking the arrangements no less than 5 times before doing the last tapping operation with one pull on the operating handle. That after a long breath. This was something he'd observed a few times but never actually done himself. And though he was pretty good with tools, he was a retired bosun, not a machinist's mate. Finished, he dismounted the barrel and reassembled the pistol, heading outside with a box of 22 long rifle ammunition. Kelly had never been intimidated by the large, heavy Colt automatic, But the cost of 45 ACP was far higher than that of 22 rimfire cartridges, and so the previous year he'd purchased a conversion kit allowing the lighter rounds to be fired through the pistol.
He tossed the Coke can about 15 feet before loading 3 rounds in the magazine. He didn't bother with ear protection. He stood as he always did, relaxed, hands at his sides, then brought the gun up fast, dropping into a crouching two-hand stance. Kelly stopped cold, realizing that the can screwed onto the barrel blanked out his sights. That would be a problem. The gun went back down, then came up again, and Kelly squeezed off the first round without actually seeing the target, with the predictable results. When he looked, the can was untouched. That was the bad news. The good news was that the suppressor had functioned well. Often misrepresented by TV and movie sound editors into an almost musical zing, the noise radiated by a really good silencer is much like that made by swiping a metal brush along a piece of finished lumber. The expanding gas from the cartridge was trapped in the baffles as the bullet passed through the holes, largely plugging them and forcing the gas to expand in the enclosed spaces inside the can. With 5 internal baffles, the cover plate made for number 6, the noise of the firing was muted to a whisper. All of which was fine, Kelly thought, but if you missed the target, he would probably hear the even louder sound of the pistol's slide racking back and forth, and the mechanical sounds of a firearm were impossible to mistake for anything harmless. Missing a soda can at 15 feet did not speak well of his marksmanship. The human head was bigger, of course, but his target area inside the human head was not. Kelly relaxed and tried again, bringing the gun up from his side in a smooth and quick arc. This time he started pulling the trigger just as the silencer can began to occult the target. It worked, after a fashion. The can went down with a 22-inch hole 1 inch from the bottom. Kelly's timing wasn't quite right. His next shot was roughly in the center of the can, however, evoking a smile. He ejected the magazine, loading 5 hollow-point rounds, and a minute later, the can was no longer usable as a target. With 7 holes, 6 of them roughly grouped in the center. "Still have the old touch, Johnny boy," Kelly said to himself, safing the pistol. But this was in daylight against a stationary piece of red metal, and Kelly knew that. He walked back to his shop and stripped the pistol down again. The suppressor had tolerated the use without any apparent damage, but he cleaned it anyway, lightly oiling the internal parts. One more thing, he thought. With a small brush and white enamel, he painted a straight white line down the top of the slide. Now it was 2 in the afternoon. Kelly allowed himself a light lunch before starting his afternoon exercises.
"Wow, that much?"
"You complaining?" Tucker demanded. "What's the matter? Can't you handle it?"
"Henry, I can handle whatever you deliver," Piaggi replied, more than a little miffed at first by the man's arrogance, then wondering what might come next. "We're going to be here 3 days, Eddie Morello whined for his part.
"Don't trust your old lady that long?" Tucker grinned at the man. Eddie would have to be next, he had already decided. Morello didn't have much sense of humor anyway. His face flushed red.
"Look, Henry, settle down, everybody."
Piaggi looked at the 8 kilos of material on the table before turning back to Tucker.
"I'd love to know where you get this stuff."
"I'm sure you would, Tony, but we already talked about that. Can you handle it?"
"You gotta remember, once you start this sort of thing, it's kinda hard to stop it. People depend on you. Kinda like what do you tell the bear when you're out of cookies, you know?"
Piaggi was already thinking. He had contacts in Philadelphia and New York. Young men, like himself, tired of working for a mustache with old-fashioned rules. The money potential here was stunning. Henry had access to what, he wondered. They had started only 2 months before, with 2 kilograms that had assayed out to a degree of purity that only the best Sicilian white matched, but at half the delivery price. And the problems associated with delivery were Henry's, not his, which made the deal doubly attractive. Finally, the physical security arrangements were what most impressed Piaggi. Henry was no dummy. not some upstart with big ideas and small brains. He was, in fact, a businessman, calm and professional, someone who might make a serious ally and associate, Piaggi thought now.
My supply is pretty solid. Let me worry about that, Paisan.
Okay. Piaggi nodded.
There is one problem, Henry. It'll take me a while to get the cash together for something this big. You should have warned me, man.
Tucker allowed himself a laugh.
I didn't want to scare you off, Anthony.
Trust me on the money?
A nod and a look. I know you're a serious guy.
Which was the smart play. Piaggi wouldn't walk away from the chance to establish a regular supply to his associates. The long-term money was just too good. Angelo Verano might not have grasped that, but he had served as the means to meet Piaggi, and that was enough. Besides, Angelo was now crab shit.
"This is pure stuff, same as before?" Morello asked, annoying both of the others.
"Eddie, the man isn't going to trust us on the cash and fuck us at the same time, is he?" Piaggi asked.
"Gentlemen, let me tell you what's happening here, okay? I got a big supply of good stuff. Where I get it, how I get it, that's my business. I even got a territory I don't want you fooling with, but we ain't bumped heads yet on the street, and we'll keep it that way."
Both of the Italians nodded, Tucker saw. Eddie dumbly, but Tony with understanding and respect. Piaggi spoke the same way.
"You need distribution. We can handle that. You have your own territory, and we can respect that, too."
It was time for the next play.
"I didn't get this far by being stupid. After today, you guys are out of this part of the business."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean no more boat rides. I mean you guys don't handle the material anymore."
Piaggi smiled. He'd done this 4 times now, and the novelty had already worn off.
"You have no argument from me on that. If you want, I can have my people take deliveries whenever you want."
"We separate the stuff from the money. We handle it like a business," Tucker said. "Line of credit-like."
"The stuff comes over first."
"Fair enough, Tony.
You pick good people, okay? The idea is we separate you and me from the drugs as much as possible."
"People get caught, they talk," Morello pointed out. He felt excluded from the conversation, but wasn't quite bright enough to grasp the significance of that.
"Mine don't," Tucker said evenly. "My people know better."
"That was you, wasn't it?" Piaggi asked, making the connection and getting a nod.
"I like your style, Henry. Try to be more careful next time, okay? I spent 2 years getting this all set up. Cost me a lot of money. I want this operation to run for a long time, and I'm not taking any more chances than I have to anymore. Now, when can you pay me off for this load?"
"I brought an even 100 with me."
Tony waved towards the duffel bag on the deck. This little operation had grown with surprising rapidity as it was, but the first 3 loads had sold off for fine prices, and Tucker, Piaggi thought, was a man you could trust, insofar as you could trust anyone in this line of work. But he figured a rip would have happened already if that was what Tucker wanted, and this much drugs was too much for a guy running that kind of setup.
"It's yours to take, Henry. Looks like we're going to owe you another 500? I'll need some time, like a week or so. Sorry, man, but you kind of sandbagged me this way. Takes time to front up that much cash, you know."
"Call it 4, Tony. No sense squeezing your friends first time out. Let's generate a little goodwill at first, okay?"
"Special introductory offer?"
Piaggi laughed at that and tossed Henry a beer.
"You gotta have some Italian blood in you, boy."
"Okay. We'll do it like you say, man."
"Just how good is that supply of yours, Henry?" Piaggi couldn't ask.
"And now there's work to do." Tucker slit open the first plastic bag and dumped it into a stainless steel mixing bowl, glad that he wouldn't have to trouble himself with this mess again. The 7th step in his marketing plan was now complete. From now on, he'd have others do this kitchen stuff, under his supervision at first, of course. But starting today, Henry Tucker would start acting like the executive he had become. Mixing the inert material into the bowl, he congratulated himself on his intelligence. He'd started the business in exactly the right way, taking risks, but carefully considered ones, building his organization from the bottom up, doing things himself, getting his hands dirty. Perhaps Piaggi's antecedents had started the same way, Tucker thought. Probably Tony had forgotten that, and forgotten also its implications. But that wasn't Tucker's problem.
"Look, Colonel, I was just an aide, okay? How many times do I have to tell you that? I did the same thing your general's aides do, all the littler dumb stuff."
"Then why take such a job?"
It was sad, Colonel Nikolai Yevgenievich Grishinov thought, that a man had to go through this, but Colonel Zacharias wasn't a man. He was an enemy, the Russian reminded himself with some reluctance, and he wanted to get the man talking again.
"Isn't it the same in your Air Force? You get noticed by a general, and you get promoted a lot faster."
The American paused for a moment.
"I wrote speeches, too."
That couldn't get him into any trouble, could it?
"That's the job of a political officer in my Air Force." Grishinov dismissed that frivolity with a wave. It was their sixth session. Grishinov was the only Soviet officer allowed to interview these Americans. The Vietnamese were playing their cards so carefully. 20 of them, all the same, all different. Zacharias was as much an intelligence officer as fighter pilot, his dossier said. He'd spent his 20-odd-year career studying air defense systems. A master's degree from the University of California, Berkeley, in electrical engineering. The dossier even included a recently acquired copy of his master's thesis, Aspects of Microwave Propagation and Diffusion Over Angular Terrain, photocopied from the university archives by some helpful soul, one of the unknown three who had contributed to his knowledge of the colonel. The thesis ought to have been classified immediately upon its completion, as would have happened in the Soviet Union, Grishinov knew. It was a very clever examination of what happened to low-frequency search radar energy, and how, incidentally, an aircraft could use mountains and hills to mask itself from it. 3 years after that, following a tour of duty in a fighter squadron, he'd been assigned to a tour of duty at Offutt Air Force Base, just outside Omaha, Nebraska. Part of the Strategic Air Command's war plan staff, he'd worked on flight profiles which might allow American B-52 bombers to penetrate Soviet air defenses, applying his theoretical knowledge of physics to the practical world of strategic nuclear war. Grishinov could not bring himself to hate this man. A fighter pilot himself, having just completed a regimental command in PVO Stranye, the Soviet Air Defense Command, and already selected for another, the Russian colonel was, in a curious way, Zacharias's exact counterpart. His job, in the event of war, was to stop those bombers from ravaging his country, and in peace to plan methods of making their penetration of Soviet airspace as difficult as possible. That identity made his current job both difficult and necessary. Not a KGB officer, certainly not one of these little brown savages, he took no pleasure at all in hurting people. Shooting them down was something else entirely, even Americans who plotted the destruction of his country. But those who knew how to extract information did not know how to analyze what he was looking for, nor even what questions to ask. And writing the questions down would be no help. You had to see the man's eyes when he spoke. A man clever enough to formulate such plans was also clever enough to lie with enough conviction and authority to fool almost anyone. Grishinov didn't like what he saw now. This was a skillful man, and a courageous one, who had fought to establish missile-hunting specialists the Americans called wild weasels. It was a term a Russian might have used for the mission, named for vicious little predators who chased their prey into their very dens. This prisoner had flown 89 such missions, if the Vietnamese had recovered the right pieces from the right aircraft. Like Russians, Americans kept a record of their accomplishments on their aircraft. This was exactly the man he needed to talk to. Perhaps that was a lesson he would write about, Grishinov thought. Such pride told your enemies whom they had captured, and much of what he knew. But that was the way of fighter pilots, and Grishinov would himself have balked at the concealment of his deeds against his country's enemies. The Russian also tried to tell himself that he was sparing harm to the man across the table. Probably Zacharias had killed many Vietnamese, and not simple peasants, but skilled, Russian-trained missile technicians, and this country's government would want to punish him for that. But that was not his concern, and he didn't want to allow political feelings to get in the way of his professional obligations. His was one of the most scientific and certainly the most complex aspects of national defense. It was his duty to plan for an attack of hundreds of aircraft, each of which had a crew of highly trained specialists. The way they thought, their tactical doctrine, was as important as their plans. And as far as he was concerned, the Americans could kill all of the bastards they wanted. The nasty little fascists had as much to do with his country's political philosophy as cannibals did with gourmet cooking. "Colonel, I do know better than that," Grishinov said patiently. He laid the most recently arrived document on the table. "I read this last night. It's excellent work." The Russian's eyes never left Colonel Zacharias. The American's physical reaction was remarkable. Though something of an intelligence officer himself, he had never dreamed that someone in Vietnam could get word to Moscow. Then to have Americans under their control find something like this. His face proclaimed what he was thinking. How could they know so much about me? How could they have reached that far back into his past? Who possibly could have done it? Was anyone that good, that professional? The Vietnamese were such fools. Like many Russian officers, Grishinov was a serious and thorough student of military history. He'd read all manner of arcane documents while sitting in regimental ready rooms. From one he'd never forget, he learned how the Luftwaffe had interrogated captured airmen, and that lesson was one he would try to apply here. While physical abuse had only hardened this man's resolve, he had just been shaken to his soul by a mere sheaf of paper. Every man had strengths and every man had weaknesses. It took a person of intelligence to recognize the differences.
"How is it that this was never classified?" Grishinov asked, lighting a cigarette.
"It's just theoretical physics," Zacharias said, shrugging his thin shoulders, recovering enough that he tried to conceal his despair. "The telephone company was more interested than anybody else." Grishinov tapped the thesis with his finger.
"Well, I tell you, I learned several things from that last night. Predicting false echoes from topographical maps, modeling the blind spots mathematically. You can plan an approach route that way, plot maneuvers from one such point to another. Brilliant! Tell me, what sort of place is Berkeley?"
"Just a school, California-style," Zacharias replied before catching himself. He was talking. He wasn't supposed to talk. He was trained not to talk. He was trained on what to expect, and what he could safely do, how to evade and disguise. But that training never quite anticipated this. And, dear God, was he tired, and scared, and sick of living up to a code of conduct that didn't count for beans to anyone else.
"I know little of your country, except professional matters, of course. Are there great regional differences? You come from Utah. What sort of place is it?"
"Zacharias, Robin G., Colonel." Grishinov raised his hands. "Please, Colonel, I know all that. I also know your place of birth in addition to the date. There is no base of your Air Force near Salt Lake City. All I know is from maps. I will probably never visit this part, any part of your country. In this Berkeley part of California, it is green, yes? I was told once they grow wine grapes there. But I know nothing of Utah. There is a large lake there, but it's called Salt Lake, yes? It's salty?"
"Yes, that's why..."
"How can it be salty? The ocean is 1,000 kilometers away, with mountains in between, yes?" He didn't give the American time to reply. "I know the Caspian Sea quite well.
I was stationed at a base there once. It isn't salty. But this place is? How strange.
He stubbed out his cigarette. The man's head jerked up a little.
Not sure, I'm not a geologist. Something left over from another time, I suppose.
Perhaps so.
There are mountains there too, yes?
Wasatch Mountains, Zacharias confirmed, somewhat drunkenly.
One clever thing about the Vietnamese, Grishinov thought, the way they fed their prisoners. Food a hog would eat only from necessity. He wondered if it were a deliberate and thought-out diet, or something fortuitously resulting from mere barbarity. Political prisoners in the gulag ate better, but the diet of these Americans lowered their resistance to disease, debilitated them to the point that the act of escape would be doomed by inadequate stamina. Rather like what the fascisti did to Soviet prisoners, distasteful or not, it was useful to Grishinov. Resistance, physical and mental, required energy, and you could watch these men lose their strength during the hours of interrogation, watch their courage wane as their physical needs drew more and more upon their supply of psychological resolve. He was learning how to do this. It was time-consuming, but it was a diverting process, learning to pick apart the brains of men not unlike himself.
The skiing, it is good.
Zacharias's eyes blinked, as though the question took him away to a different time and place.
Yeah, it is. That is something one will never do here, Colonel. I like cross-country skiing for exercise, and to get away from things. I had wooden skis, but in my last regiment, my maintenance officer made me steel skis from aircraft parts.
Steel?
Stainless steel. Heavier than aluminum, but more flexible. I prefer it. From a wing panel on our new interceptor, Project E-266.
What's that?
Zacharias knew nothing of the new MiG-25.
Your people now call it Foxbat. Very fast, designed to catch one of your B-70 bombers.
But we stopped that project, Zacharias objected.
Yes, I know that. But your project got me a wonderfully fast fighter to fly. When I return home, I will command the first regiment of them.
Fighter planes made of steel?
Why? It resists aerodynamic heating much better than aluminum, Grishinov explained. And you can make good skis from discarded parts.
Zacharias was very confused now.
So, how well do you think we would do with my steel fighters and your aluminum bombers?
I guess that depends on... Zacharias started to say, then stopped himself cold. His eyes looked across the table, first with confusion at what he'd almost said, then with resolve.
Too soon, Grishinov told himself with disappointment.
He'd pushed a little too soon. This one had courage. Enough to take his wild weasel downtown, the phrase the Americans used, over 80 times. Enough to resist for a long time. But Grishinov had plenty of time.
Chapter 12. Outfitters. 63 VW, low mileage, radiator, heater. Kelly dropped a dime in the payphone and called the number. It was a blazing hot Saturday. Temperature and humidity in a neck-and-neck race for triple digits while Kelly fumed at his own stupidity. Some things were so blatantly obvious that you didn't see them until your nose split open and started bleeding.
Hello?
I'm calling about the ad for the car.
That's right, Kelly said.
Right now, if you want.
Okay. Say about 15 minutes?
Fine, thank you, ma'am. I'll be right there.
Bye.
He hung up.
At least something had gone right.
Kelly grimaced at the inside of the phone booth. Springer was tied up in a guest slip at one of the marinas on the Potomac. He had to buy a new car, but how did you get to where the new car was?
If you drove there, then you could drive the new car back.
But what about the one you took?
It was funny enough that he started laughing at himself. Then fate intervened. and an empty cab went driving past the marina's entrance, allowing him to keep his promise to a little old lady. "The 4500 block, Essex Avenue," he told the driver.
"Where's that, man?"
"Bethesda."
"Gonna cost extra, man," the driver pointed out, turning north.
Kelly handed a $10 bill across. "Another one if you get me there in 15 minutes."
"Cool."
And the acceleration dropped Kelly back in his seat. The taxi avoided Wisconsin Avenue most of the way. At a red light, the driver found Essex Avenue on his map, and he ended up collecting the extra 10 with about 20 seconds to spare. It was an upscale residential neighborhood, and the house was easy to spot. There it was, a VW Beetle, an awful peanut butter color speckled with a little body rust. It could not have been much better. Kelly hopped up the 4 wooden front steps and knocked on the door.
"Hello?"
It was a face to match the voice. She had to be 80 or so, small and frail, but with fey green eyes that hinted at what had been, enlarged by the thick glasses she wore. Her hair still had some yellow in the gray.
"Mrs. Boyd, I called a little while ago about the car."
"What's your name?"
"Bill Murphy, ma'am."
Kelly smiled benignly.
"Awful hot, isn't it?"
"Terrible," she said, meaning terrible.
"Wait a minute."
Gloria Boyd disappeared and then came back a moment later with the keys. She even came out to walk him to the car. Kelly took her arm to help her down the steps.
"Thank you, young man."
"My pleasure, ma'am," he replied gallantly.
"We got the car for my granddaughter. When she went to college, then Ken used it," she said, expecting Kelly to know who Ken was.
"Excuse me?"
"My husband," Gloria said without turning. "He died a month ago."
"I'm very sorry to hear that, ma'am."
"He was sick a long time," said the woman, not yet recovered from the shock of her loss, but accepting the fact of it.
She handed him the keys.
"Here, take a look."
Kelly unlocked the door. It looked like the car used by a college student and then by an elderly man. The seats were well worn, and one had a long slash in it, probably by a packing box of clothes or books. He turned the key in the lock, and the engine started immediately. There was even a full tank of gas. The ad hadn't lied about the mileage, only 52,000 miles on the odometer. He asked for and got permission to take it around the block. The car was mechanically sound, he decided, bringing it back to the waiting owner.
"Where did all the rust come from?" he asked her, giving the keys back. "She went to school in Chicago, at Northwestern. All that terrible snow and salt."
"That's a good school. Let's get you back inside." Kelly took her arm and directed her back to the house. It smelled like an old person's house, the air heavy with dust that she was too tired to wipe, and stale food, for the meals she still fixed were for two, not one.
"Are you thirsty?"
"Yes, ma'am, thank you. Water will be just fine." Kelly looked around while she went to the kitchen. There was a photo on the wall, a man in a high-necked uniform and Sam Brown belt, holding the arm of a young woman in a very tight, almost cylindrical, white wedding dress. Other photos catalogued the married life of Kenneth and Gloria Boyd. Two daughters and a son, a trip to the ocean, an old car, grandchildren, all the things earned in a full and useful life.
"Here you go."
She handed over a glass.
"Thank you."
"What did your husband do?"
"He worked for the Commerce Department for 42 years. We were going to move to Florida, but then he got sick, so now I'm going alone. My sister lives in Fort Pierce. She's a widow, too. Her husband was a policeman."
Her voice trailed off as the cat came in to examine the new visitor. That seemed to invigorate Mrs. Boyd.
"I'm moving down there next week. The house is already sold. Have to get out next Thursday. I sold it to a nice young doctor."
"I hope you like it down there, ma'am. How much do you want for the car?"
"I can't drive anymore because of my eyes. Cataracts.
People have to drive me everywhere I go. My grandson says it's worth $1,500.
Your grandson must be a lawyer to be that greedy, Kelly thought.
How about $1,200? I can pay cash.
Cash?
Her eyes became fey again.
Yes, ma'am.
Then you can have the car.
She held out her hand, and Kelly took it carefully.
Do you have the paperwork?
It made Kelly feel guilty that she had to get up again, this time heading upstairs, slowly, holding on to the banister while Kelly took out his wallet and counted off 12 crisp bills. It should have taken only another 10 minutes, but instead it was 30. Kelly had already checked up on how to do the mechanics of a title transfer, and besides, he wasn't going to do all of that. The auto insurance policy was tucked into the same cardboard envelope as the title, in the name of Kenneth W. Boyd. Kelly promised to take care of that for her, and the tags too, of course. But it turned out that all the cash made Mrs. Boyd nervous, and so Kelly helped her fill out a deposit ticket, and then drove her to the bank, where she could drop it into the night depository. Then he stopped off at the supermarket for milk and cat food before bringing her home and walking her to the door again.
"Thank you for the car, Mrs. Boyd," he said in parting.
"What are you going to use it for?"
"Business."
Kelly smiled and left.
At 9:15 that night, two cars pulled into the service area on Interstate 95. The one in front was a Dodge Dart, and the one behind it a red Plymouth Roadrunner. Roughly 50 feet apart, they picked a half-full area north of Maryland House, a rest stop set in the median of the John F. Kennedy Highway, offering full restaurant services along with gas and oil. Good coffee, but understandably no alcoholic beverages. The Dart took a few meandering turns in the parking lot, finally stopping 3 spaces from a white Oldsmobile with Pennsylvania tags and a brown vinyl top. The Roadrunner took a space in the next row. A woman got out and walked towards the brick restaurant, a path that took her past the Olds.
"Hey, baby," a man said.
The woman stopped and took a few steps towards the vinyl-topped automobile. The man was Caucasian, with long but neatly combed black hair and an open-necked white shirt.
"Henry sent me," she said.
"I know."
He reached out to stroke her face, a gesture which she did not resist. He looked around a little before moving his hand downwards.
"You have what I want, baby?"
"Yes."
She smiled. It was a forced, uneasy smile, frightened but not embarrassed. Doris was months beyond embarrassment.
"Nice tits," the man said, with no emotional content at all in his voice.
"Get the stuff." Doris walked back to her car, as though she'd forgotten something. She returned with a large purse, almost a small duffel, really. As she walked past the Olds, the man's hand reached out and took it. Doris proceeded into the building, returning a minute later holding a can of soda, her eyes on the Roadrunner, hoping that she'd done everything right. The Olds had its motor running, and the driver blew her a kiss, to which she responded with a wan smile.
"That was easy enough," Henry Tucker said, 50 yards away, at the outdoor eating area on the other side of the building.
"Good stuff?" another man asked Tony Piaggi.
The three of them sat at the same table, enjoying the sultry evening while the majority of the patrons were inside with the air conditioning.
"The best. Same as the sample we gave you 2 weeks ago. Same shipment and everything," Piaggi assured him.
"And if the mule gets burned?" the man from Philadelphia asked.
"She won't talk," Tucker assured him. "We've all seen what happens to bad girls."
As they watched, a man got out of the Roadrunner and got into the Dart's driver's seat.
"Very good," Rick told Doris.
"Can we go now?" she asked him, shaking now that the job was over, sipping nervously at her soda.
"Sure, baby. I know what you want."
Rick smiled and started the car.
"Be nice now. Show me something."
"There's people around," Doris said.
"So?"
Without another word, Doris unbuttoned her shirt. It was a man's shirt, leaving it tucked into her faded shorts,
Rick reached in and smiled, turning the wheel with his left hand. It could have been worse, Doris told herself, closing her eyes, pretending that she was someone else in some other place, wondering how long before her life would end too, hoping it wouldn't be long.
The money? Piaggi asked.
I need a cup of coffee. The other man got up and walked inside, leaving his briefcase, which Piaggi took in his hand. He and Tucker walked off to his car, a blue Cadillac, without waiting for the other man to come back.
Not going to count it? Tucker asked halfway across the parking lot.
If he stiffs us, he knows what happens. This is business, Henry.
That's right, Tucker agreed.
Bill Murphy, Kelly said. I understand you have some vacant apartments. He held up the Sunday paper.
What are you looking for?
A one-bedroom would be fine. I really just need a place to hang my clothes, Kelly told the man. I travel a lot.
Salesman? The manager asked.
Well, that's right. Machine tools. I'm new here. A new territory, I mean. It was an old garden apartment complex built soon after the Second World War for returning veterans, composed exclusively of three-story brick structures. The trees looked about right for that time period. They'd been planted then and grown well, tall enough now to support a good population of squirrels, wide enough to give shade to the parking areas. Kelly looked around approvingly as the manager took him to a first-floor furnished unit.
This is just fine, Kelly announced.
He looked around, testing the kitchen sink and other plumbing fixtures. The furniture was obviously used, but in decent shape. There were even air conditioners in the windows of every room.
I have other ones.
This is just what I need.
How much?
$175 a month, 1 month security deposit.
Utilities?
You can pay them yourself, or we can bill it. Some of our renters prefer that. They'll average about $45 a month.
Easier to pay one bill than two or three. Let's see, 175 plus 45.
220, the manager said helpfully.
440, Kelly corrected.
2 months, right? I can pay you with a check, but it's an out-of-town bank. I don't have a local account yet. Is cash okay?
Cash is always okay with me, the manager assured him.
Fine. Kelly took out his wallet, handing over the bills. He stopped.
No, 660. We'll make it 3 months if that's okay.
And I need a receipt. The helpful manager pulled a pad from his pocket and wrote one up on the spot.
How about a phone? Kelly asked.
I can have that done by Tuesday if you want. There's another deposit for that.
Please take care of that if you would.
Kelly handed over some more money.
My stuff won't be here for a while. Where can I get sheets and stuff?
Nothing much open today. Tomorrow, lots of them.
Kelly looked through the bedroom door at the bare mattress. He could see the lumps from this distance. He shrugged.
Well, I've slept on worse.
Veteran?
Marine, Kelly said.
So was I once, the manager replied, surprising Kelly.
You don't do anything wild, do you?
He didn't expect so, but the owner insisted that he ask, even ex-Marines. The answer was a sheepish, reassuring grin.
I snore pretty bad, they tell me.
20 minutes later, Kelly was in a cab heading downtown. He got out at Penn Station and caught the next train to D.C., where another taxi delivered him to his boat. By nightfall, Springer was headed down the Potomac. It would have been so much easier, Kelly told himself, if there were just one person to help him. So much of his time was tied up with useless commuting. But was it really useless?
Maybe not.
He was getting a lot of thinking done, and that was as important as his physical preparations. Kelly arrived at his home just before midnight after 6 continuous hours of thinking and planning. Despite a weekend of almost non-stop motion, there was no time to dawdle. Kelly packed clothing, most of it purchased in the suburbs of Washington. Linens he would buy in Baltimore. Food the same. His 45 automatic, plus the 22 to 45 conversion kit, was packed in with old clothing, along with 2 boxes of ammunition. He shouldn't need more than that, Kelly thought,
and ammo was heavy. While he fabricated one more silencer, this one for the woodsman, he thought through his preparations. His physical condition was excellent, nearly as good as it had been in Third SOG, and he'd been shooting every day. His aim was probably better than it had ever been, he told himself, going through what were now almost mindless mechanical operations on the machine tools. By 3 in the morning, the new suppressor was fitted to the woodsman and tested. 30 minutes after that, he was back aboard Springer, headed north, looking forward to a few hours' sleep once he got past Annapolis. It was a lonely night, with scattered clouds, and his mind drifted somewhat before he commanded himself to concentrate. He was not a lazy civilian anymore, but Kelly allowed himself his first beer in weeks while his mind churned over variables. What had he forgotten? The reassuring answer was that he could think of nothing. The less than satisfactory thought was that he still knew little. Billy with his red Plymouth muscle car. A black guy named Henry. He knew their area of operation. And that was all. But he'd fought armed and trained enemies with less knowledge than that. And though he would force himself to be just as careful now as he had been there, deep down he knew that he would accomplish this mission. Partly it was because he was more formidable than they, and far more highly motivated. The other part, Kelly realized with surprise, was because he didn't care about the consequences, only the results. He remembered something from his Catholic prep school, a passage from Virgil's Aeneid that had defined his mission almost 2,000 years before. Una salus victus, nullam sperare salutem. The one hope of the doomed is not to hope for safety. The very grimness of the thought made him smile as he sailed under the stars, light dispatched from distances so vast that it had begun its journey long before Kelly, or even Virgil, had been born. The pills helped shut out reality, but not all the way. Doris didn't so much think the thought as listen to it, sense it, like recognizing something that she didn't wish to face but refused to go away. She was too dependent on the barbiturates now. Sleep came hard to her, and in the emptiness of the room she was unable to avoid herself. She would have taken more pills if she could, but they didn't allow her what she wanted. Not that she wanted much. Just brief oblivion. A short-term liberation from her fear, that was all. And that was something they had no interest in granting her. She could see more than they knew or would have expected. She could peer into the future. But that was little consolation. Sooner or later, she would be caught by the police. She'd been arrested before, but not for something of this magnitude, and she'd go away for a long time for this. The police would try to get her to talk, promise her protection. She knew better. Twice now she'd seen friends die. Friends? As close to that as was possible. Someone to talk to. Someone who shared her life, such as it was. And even in this captivity there were little jokes, small victories against the forces that ruled her existence, like distant lights in a gloomy sky. Someone to cry with. But two of them were dead, and she'd watched them die, sitting there, drugged but unable to sleep and blotted out, the horror so vast that it became numbing, watching their eyes, seeing and feeling the pain, knowing that she could do nothing, knowing even that they knew it as well. A nightmare was bad enough, but one of those couldn't reach out and touch you. You could wake up and flee from one of those, not this. She could watch herself from outside, as though she were a robot outside her own command, but not that of others. Her body would not move unless others commanded it, and she even had to conceal her thoughts, was even afraid to voice them within her own mind, lest they hear them or see them on her face. But now, try as she might, she could not force them away. Rick lay next to her, breathing slowly in the darkness. Part of her liked Rick. He was the gentlest of them, and sometimes she allowed herself to think that he liked her, maybe a little, because he didn't beat her badly,
She had to stay in line, of course, because his anger was every bit as bad as Billy's. And so, around Rick, she tried very hard to be good. Part of her knew that it was foolish, but her reality was defined by other people now. And she'd seen the results of real resistance. After one especially bad night, Pam had held her and whispered her desires to escape. Later, Doris had prayed that she had gotten away, that there might be hope after all, only to see her dragged in and to watch her die, sitting helplessly 15 feet away while they did everything to her that they could imagine, watching her life end, her body convulsing from lack of oxygen with the man's face staring at her, laughing at her from an inch away. Her only act of resistance, thankfully unnoticed by the men, had been to brush out her friend's hair, crying all the while, hoping somehow that Pam would know there was someone who cared, even in death. But the gesture had seemed empty, even as she'd done it, making her tears all the more bitter. What had she done wrong, Doris wondered? How badly had she offended God that her life should be this way? How could anyone possibly deserve such a bleak and hopeless existence? "I'm impressed, John," Rosen said, staring at his patient. Kelly sat on the examining table, his shirt off. "What have you been doing?" 5-mile swim for the shoulders. Better than weights, but a little of that, too, in the evening. A little running. About what I used to do back in the old days." "I wish I had your blood pressure," the surgeon observed, removing the cuff. He'd done a major procedure that morning, but he made time for his friend. "Exercise, Sam," Kelly advised. "I don't have the time, John," the surgeon said. Rather weakly, both thought. "A doc should know better." "True," Rosen conceded. "How are you otherwise?" The reply was just a look, neither a smile nor a grimace. Just a neutral expression that told Rosen all he needed to know. One more try. There's an old saying, before setting out on revenge, dig 2 graves. "Only 2? Kelly asked lightly. Rosen nodded. "I read the post report, too. I can't talk you out of it." "How's Sarah?" Rosen accepted the deflection with good grace. "Deep into her project. She's excited enough that she's telling me about it. It's pretty interesting stuff." Just then, Sandy O'Toole came in. Kelly startled both of them by lifting his T-shirt and covering his chest. "Please!" The nurse was so startled that she laughed, and so did Sam until he realized that Kelly was indeed ready for whatever he was planning. The conditioning, the looseness, the steady, serious eyes that changed to mirth when he wanted them to. Like a surgeon, Rosen thought. And what a strange thought that was. But the more he looked at this man, the more intelligence he saw. "You're looking healthy for a guy who got shot a few weeks ago," O'Toole said with a friendly look. "Clean living, ma'am. Only 1 beer in 30-some days." "Mrs. Lott is conscious now, Dr. Rosen," the nurse reported. "Nothing unusual. She appears to be doing fine. Her husband's been in to see her. I think he'll be okay, too. I had my doubts." "Thanks, Sandy." "Well, John, you're healthy, too. Put your shirt on before Sandy starts blushing," Rosen added with a chuckle. "Where do you get lunch around here?" Kelly asked. "I'd show you myself, but I have a conference in about 10 minutes. Sandy?" She checked her watch. "About time for mine. You want to risk hospital food or something outside?" "You're the tour guide, ma'am." She guided him to the cafeteria, where the food was hospital bland, but you could add salt and other spices if you wanted. Kelly selected something that might be filling, even healthy, to compensate for the lack of taste. "Have you been keeping busy?" he asked after they selected a table. "Always," Sandy assured him. "Where do you live?" "Off Loch Raven Boulevard, just in the county." She hadn't changed, Kelly saw. Sandy O'Toole was functioning quite well, in fact, but the emptiness in her life wasn't qualitatively different from his. The real difference was that he could do something. She could not. She was reaching out. She had a capacity for good humor, but her grief overcame it at every turn. A powerful force, grief. There were advantages in having enemies you could seek out and eliminate.